So I tend to go to a lot of craft fairs, no matter where I am. I'm currently doing fieldwork for my dissertation, and even now I'm spending the weekend looking at handmade jewelry and antiques in large fairgrounds across the Middle East. One of the big trends in jewelry in the Middle East is jewelry with Arabic font on it. So verses from the Quran, poetry, calligraphy. You can custom order this stuff on Instagram too. Jewelry designers are also doing something that's quite interesting. They're going to calligraphy school to learn how to make fonts that evoke calligraphy in their designs. But that begs the question, where did Arabic font come from to begin with? What's its relationship to calligraphy? My name is Aneh Mansour, or Nadira, and I'm a graduate student at Princeton University's Department of Near Eastern Studies, and welcome to New Books in Middle East Studies. We'll be talking sort of about the history of the book, calligraphy, font, all of these topics will swirl together. And my guest is Hala Aouji, who is an assistant professor of art history in the Department of Fine Arts and Art History at the American University of Beirut, or AUB. She holds a PhD in art history from Binghamton University, an MA in art criticism and theory from Art Center College of Design, and a BFA in graphic design from AUB itself. Her research interests include, amongst many, Arabic book and print culture, 19th century Islamic art and architecture, and the history of modern science in the Islamic world. She's the author of a new book, out 2016 from Brill, Printing Arab Modernity, which is a history of the American Protestant mission's Arabic publications printed in Beirut for Ottoman readers during the 19th century, the subject of today's podcast. So welcome to the podcast, Hala.
Thank you for having me.
So I have been talking about your book nonstop for I think roughly since July when I read it for the first time. I think it is a phenomenal addition to the growing history of the book, of to intellectual history. When I talk to people about it, they often say, you know, it's a very specific book. It's almost a micro history because it's so focused on the American Protestants' mission and what they printed. I'm like, no, you don't understand. This tells this larger regional history. It's so useful to me and what I do as an aspiring intellectual historian who works on newspapers. So congratulations on the book. It's phenomenal.
Thank you.
So we take text and print for granted in our day and age, as we do literacy. And I was just very generally, what does print culture mean to you? How would you define it?
Well, yeah, I mean, print culture is those, you know, very everyday items that we take for granted, as you just said. It's, you know, print culture for all its profusion in society today in the form of newspapers, books, magazines, booklets, posters, and so on. It's actually something that we rarely notice as a material form in its materiality. You know, we read and we look at this material, but unless we're told otherwise, we don't really engage with it critically. We don't really consider these items as objects per se.
Yeah, I think I was telling someone recently that my dissertation project, one manifestation of my dissertation project was born when someone handed me a pamphlet on a bus. It was Ramadan, and it was some sort of pamphlet on, I think it was, you know, just various sort of benedictions or du'as that you can make. And I picked up the pamphlet and I was like, wow. This didn't exist 100 years ago. And then again, we interact with text in so many different ways, be it on a screen or in a book, we take it for granted. So this is a very broad question. As people who interact with books on a regular basis or text and print, what should we notice when we look at a book? What do you notice specifically when you pick up a piece of text or you see something online for the first time?
Right. I mean, the cliche, of course, is, you know, the book's cover, that we're never supposed to judge a book by the cover and so on. That somehow, you know, this attitude towards the form evokes the old adage that form is just it's supposed to follow function, or that, you know, the form of the book, its cover, its binding, its the way that it's designed, its visual conventions are not really as important as the ultimate function of the book as a bearer of textual information. But what I like to do, or what I do, what our art and design historians tend to do, is that when working with these kinds of books, is to turn a critical eye to the look of the book. You know, as readers, it's important to take notice of the other ways of reading a book as part of our experience in interacting with it. You know, things like, where do our hands go when we open the book? And, you know, when you open up a book, there are these spaces, these margins along the sides that are actually there intentionally for your hands so that you wouldn't smudge ink, you wouldn't touch the ink. But why are certain margins more narrow than others? How is text arranged on the page? You know, which visual components, when you open up a book, which visual components attract our attention first. And people like me ask the question, why? Why is it that some parts of the book immediately call out to the reader, and what does that mean as part of the reader's experience?
That's so interesting, just because we think of margins. I mean, we live in a day and age where the books we get printed are not necessarily going to smudge, but I definitely think of margins as a place where my notes go, or where, you know, I can scribble, or I can put a post-it, and we don't think of it in the same way, but these things really govern our interactions with these physical objects. And I mean, just to switch gears for a little bit, I think one of the book's strong points is the fact that you have this appreciation for Islamic script, sort of speaking of another thing that governs how things evolve. And I mentioned that you have, that one of your interests is 19th century Islamic art, and then you have this background in graphic design. So how did this specific project come about, and sort of what's your intellectual history there?
Yeah, so I mean, as you said, I was actually trained as a graphic designer. So I studied graphic design and actually worked in advertising for a bit before I decided to pursue a degree in art history. I am non-traditional in the sense that I don't have an actual proper art historical undergraduate education. So my historical interest in art is actually directly linked to my interest in the art of the book, which is in fact very much informed by my design background. When I went on to do my master's at Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, I had the rare opportunity to work at a rather cutting edge letterpress at that institution. It's called Archetype Press, which this press essentially had numerous old traditional letterpresses that they would use to produce examples of contemporary art or a take on contemporary book art. And so it's all the design. It was like a coming together of design, contemporary design, in this more traditional mode of production. And I had the opportunity to work with metal type and learn about how these kinds of things were made and how these machines worked. And I began to wonder about the history of Arabic printing. So it made sense that I would look further into this as I pursued a degree in Islamic art history. And what I realized when I was doing my PhD was that one of the main problems in this field is that Islamic art historians pay a lot of attention to manuscripts, to things done by hand, to painting. But they didn't really consider print culture to be something that is worthy of a closer critical scrutiny in the same way that you would look at, analyze manuscripts. So I saw this sort of unique opportunity to change the conversation about Arabic print culture, and to utilize some of the methods that art historians use, but for a study and a close analysis of print.
I definitely really appreciated that, just because, as I mentioned, I work on newspapers, and newspapers evolve. That period, sort of the first generation Arabic newspaper, sort of intersects with the period you're dealing with the book in the 19th century. But there's so many little things that you see that are definitely, I don't want to say hangovers, but they're definitely things that evolved from this relationship with manuscript printing. And I mean, they'll use different typefaces in different areas in newspapers or different headings, and there's a clear connection. So I definitely appreciated that. And that's something I think we need to think more about in history, is continuity versus always focusing on rupture. So as I mentioned earlier, this book is specifically about the American press. It's a very, I think a lot of, you know, in history, we're always tempted to sort of go bigger, to sort of, especially with its emphasis on global history, is to sort of incorporate more sources in, to incorporate more archives in. What I appreciated about this book is that it was very tight. It was very dense, very detailed work. But you also make this wide overarching claim, which I think definitely applies to much of print culture in the with regards to the Arabic script, which is the connection between manuscript and print culture. So, but it's also about missionaries. So can you sort of set the stage for us? What are missionaries doing at this point in time in the Middle East? Where's the intersection with the Ottoman Empire, which is where Lebanon is at the time? It's part of the Ottoman Empire.
Right. Well, this is this American press, and that's I mean, I'm using the colloquial name for this particular press in Arabic, Al-Matba' Al-Amerikaniye. It was first and foremost a Protestant missionary press in Beirut. The press was founded in 1834 in Beirut, but it was initially set up in an earlier form on Malta in 1831. Now, these American missionaries who founded this press in Beirut were part of a mission to the Ottoman Syrian provinces. So Lebanon at this time was not called Lebanon. It was actually a part of Ottoman Syria, which was really, it included modern-day Palestine and parts of Jordan and Syria and Lebanon today. And this particular mission was an extension of the Boston-based American Board of Foreign Missions, of American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. They first arrived in the area around 1820. What's interesting is that their original mission to the region was to convert Jewish and Muslim communities to Protestantism. So they spent a lot of time initially in Jerusalem, which was an Ottoman city at this time, and there was no other American presence in the region. They were under the protection of the British consul, who had diplomatic connections with the Sublime Porte, with the Ottoman state. And what's interesting is that these Americans, they quickly realized that proselytizing amongst Jewish and Muslim groups was going to be nearly impossible. There are many, you know, socio-political and cultural restrictions on this, and so they decided to focus instead on the so-called, what they called nominal Christians. And so these were any Christians who were not Protestants, Greek Orthodox, Armenian Orthodox, Maronite, and Greek Catholic communities. Many of these groups of non-Muslim minorities lived in the Syrian provinces and the Mount Lebanon region. So it made sense then that the mission would establish its headquarters in Beirut, which is a rather cosmopolitan growing port city at this time. And the press was established there. But Beirut is just one of the many stations that belong to this particular mission.
Yeah, I've always, whenever I bring up the fact that Arabic printing had sort of an early phase in Malta, people are always a little surprised. And then I'm always like, well, you know, you have all of these connections. I mean, Maltese is also, it has Arabic in it. So it's always one of those things that I really enjoy, was sort of tripping people up with that fact. Okay, so
right. The point about Malta is that the presses that were publishing in Arabic there before the American mission was the British Church Missionary Society. So they had their press there long before the Americans did in the 1820s, and they're the ones who were actually publishing Arabic books. The American press themselves, they didn't really publish Arabic books when they were in Malta. It wasn't until they moved to Beirut that they were able to procure an Arabic typeface to begin printing in Arabic.
So what drove you to focus on one press versus a constellation of presses? Because contemporary to this press in Lebanon is what we often call the press at Boulaq in Cairo, and state printing. And it's contemporary to this period, but it's also a very different project. So what drove you to focus on this one press?
Well, to be honest, I initially conceived of this project as a much, much larger scale history of Arabic printing. I wanted to cover everything, you know, Iraq, Syria, Egypt, North Africa, even Istanbul. And of course, that was an ideal. And when I delved into the research, I realized that that each of these projects had, you know, very different goals in mind at this particular time. And what drew me to the American press was a little bit of sentimentality on my part. I was really happy to find out that this being one of the earliest Arabic commercial presses in the region was actually established by the same people who founded my alma mater, the American University of Beirut. And I realized that the American press was also an important site for serving as the first publisher of books by Arab intellectuals who were non-Muslims, like Butros al-Bustani, Khalil Khoury, Tamis al-Sajjad, and so on. So I was really curious about this interesting role that the press played as a publisher of secular works, in addition to being a missionary press. And I think what sets the American press apart from Boulaq is Wula is very much a state's press. It's very much a Muslim press. And it's got its very interesting history, and there's a lot of people working on that now. With the American press, it was a bit of a weird, it had a bit of a weird thing to it, in that it's a missionary press that locals were using to produce their own works, but these were also locals who were not Muslim and would not have had the same kind of access that members of Muslim members of Ottoman communities would have had. And so it provided them with this unique opportunity to make a name for themselves in a context where it may have been a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, I would like to draw attention to the fact that many people are working on these individual presses right now. And with the Press of Bulaq, there's a dissertation, which I believe you cite, which is by Catherine Schwartz, which will hopefully be a book soon, which actually makes the same point you do. I read them together and I thought, wow, they make a pretty similar point about rupture and continuity and sort of the relationship of manuscripts to print culture, but they're doing it in these completely different contexts. And I think you both make this great greater methodological contribution. And you read texts similarly, just looking at sort of how they're composed. So to ask another very broad question, sort of what is the history of the Arabic book prior to this? I mean, we have manuscripts and many people use them. I mean, traditionally, manuscripts are sort of the bedrock of the field of Islamic studies. But how are people consuming books prior to print? How are ordinary people consuming books? Are they being consumed? What does literacy look like in that sense? And I guess we can talk both about Lebanon, but also the greater Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question, one that I'm often asked, because in the history of European, book baking, print was taking place centuries before. And so this idea that you suddenly get this rupture in the 19th century, I mean, certainly you had that type of that going on in Europe at the time, but there was a unique case going on in the Arab and Islamic world. Before the more prominent use of print, before print became the main mode of book production, as you said, manuscripts were essentially the kinds of books that people were producing or circulating. Now, the traditional understanding of this is that, you know, manuscripts belong to a very, very elite group of readers and producers, often associated in some way with the state, with the Ottoman court, or whatever state we're talking about, and that there's questions of accessibility, and this is not necessarily a kind of a way in which knowledge was shared very widely, and so you usually had manuscript workshops where you had, you know, scriptoria, where people were educated in a very hierarchical, rigid system, and books were produced for consumption by specific elite and scholarly individuals. Scholars have problematized that particular narrative. People like Dana Sejdi and Nelly Hanna have told us that, no, well, there's a consumption of books and book production beyond these rigid elite circles. And you had people who were semi-trained as calligraphers or may not have been successful calligraphers who were producing their own books and who were sharing books in a more popular way. But despite all of this, it's important to understand that, you know, books remain rather expensive. And we're certainly, I mean, not affordable as commodities for your average person. And educational systems were very different before the 19th century. And so it's not true that everybody can read, very few people can read. It's not just that the books were not widely available, it's just also that they were not necessarily, there wasn't necessarily a demand for this large amount of, I'm rambling.
Oh, no.
there's the question of demand and the question of access and all of these issues. With the emergence of print, it isn't that print changes literacy. I mean, a lot of people, you know, talk about how print is an agent of change, and I don't necessarily see it that way. Society is what determines how things happen. It's from society that you get the impetus for social change and for intellectual change. And with modernization reforms, with changes to education, you get more people interested in books, people interested in producing books and consuming books. And with changes to the technology of print itself, I mean, this is something that we don't often talk about, but the 19th century sees changes to actual printing presses. They become a lot more affordable. They become a lot more easier to use. They become a lot more easier to transport. And this coincides with the change that you see in the nature of the Arabic book at the time.
No, I absolutely agree with that. And what I love right now is we're sort of riding this very progressive wave. I think of it as a progressive wave in intellectual history of the Middle East, in book history of the Middle East, which is history of literacy, which is definitely that literacy is a tool. We shouldn't necessarily think of it as a social good. We shouldn't necessarily think of it in terms of progress. But we also shouldn't think of it as this great moment of rupture and that there's a printing revolution all of a sudden, which is one term that has been used to describe printing elsewhere and in the Middle East. And it's definitely something I think about a lot because I there's this temptation to see all these new forms that come with print as revolutionary, but time, sort of depending on your scope, your temporal scope, you can see change as both rupture and continuity. And that's something that really interests me. So just again, to go back, you mentioned what was happening in Egypt contemporary to this period, the 1820s and the 1830s, and what was being printed. And from my knowledge of it, a lot of this, and you mentioned education, was to feed into state schools to create textbooks. That's also when you have the first printings of the Quran. So what is the American press producing? Because as you mentioned, they're a missionary press. So they're not producing the same sorts of texts. Are they producing, are they going to the manuscript tradition and printing new books up from those manuscripts? Or are they producing new material? Are they producing translations?
Yeah, so they're doing many things. It all changes. And my book, what it does is, I mean, again, as you said, it's like a small slice of a big pie that is the history of Arabic printing. And I actually focus on a few decades, because what I noticed in my research is that what was happening in the 1830s was not necessarily still happening in the 1860s. This is an important period of major sociopolitical change in the region. And we see that, definitely being negotiated in the context of the American press and its publications. The press itself was initially established to produce educational books in Arabic that were meant to be used in the missionary schools and in the seminaries. So this is what was going on in the 1830s. The missionaries at that time saw what they perceived to be a paucity in Arabic school books. And so they sought to fill that void for their own purposes. To better serve the mission's vision, though, particularly the vision of the board Boston, and that vision that the board had for its foreign missions, the missionaries began to work on an Arabic translation of the Bible. And so these missionaries in Beirut argued that the main reason a press like this was necessary and needed to remain something that the board funded was that it was where they could print the Arabic Bible and associated religious texts that would then be used by catechists, that these were critical for their proselytizing project. What's interesting about this press is that from very early on, there's a dual interest in secular and in religious works for use by the mission. Now, what changes over the course of a few years is that the books that the mission prints become more and more the kind of secular works that people who were not interested in converting would purchase and would be interested in reading. And so these kinds of texts were usually, you know, the typical educational books, arithmetic, geography, grammars. They also had a few Arabic translations of evangelical fiction or religious fiction that is not explicitly religious in the sense that like books, stories like The Dairyman's Daughter and Robinson Crusoe were translated into Arabic for the local populace. And of course, you had the more religious works. You know, The Pilgrim's Progress was translated into Arabic and printed there, The Passion of the Christ, many hymnals and psalters. But as the press evolved, you start to see more and more historical, literary, poetic, and linguistic texts that were being produced not by the missionaries, but by local intellectuals. So they would be brought in to produce, to write or translate certain books that had nothing to do really with the mission's proselytizing goals, but they would produce these books and then they would be sold within the mission's press, and the mission's press acted as a bookshop of sorts. And what was really interesting is that at some point the board stops funding this press, and what ends up sustaining the press itself is the fact that local scholars would rent out the press and would pay. You know, would use the press, and I believe they would pay the mission, or at least they would hire people at their own expense, and then they would produce books, and the mission would sell some of them, and the scholars would be able to kind of have books that they would then distribute to other bookshops and magazines in town to sell.
So we're going to go even, I mean, we've already described sort of how this is a sort of a small slice or a micro history, and we're going to go sort of even more further in, take more of a microscopic lens, because one of the great accomplishments of this book is its focus on font and typography. And I mentioned to you at some point that I've been talking about your book since July, and one of the conversations that spawned from me and a friend realizing that we had both read your book and discussing it was she works on the history of the physical Quran, what we call the Mus'haf, and she and I were sitting in a cafe in Cairo and talking about, you know, our research for the day, what we've done. And she pulls out her phone and she's showing me some pictures of some samples. And we're like, okay, we got to look on it on the computer screen. So we look, because we need to like look at the font up close. It's not working just looking at it on a computer screen. And we're sitting there marveling over the difference between the fonts of my newspapers that are printed in the late 1880s for that particular week and her printings of the Quran from across the 19th century. And we're just marveling over the difference in font, how beautiful the font for the Quran was. And at some point, someone walked behind us, the owner of the cafe who knows us quite well, and he was just like, you guys are nerds. You're like marveling over font. But that's definitely the impact your book had, is it taught me the importance of font, because I never really took it seriously before. I think I always took the material aspect of what I studied quite seriously, like how does someone hold a newspaper? But I never took in consideration like, oh, well, the font looks like this, so it means this. So more specifically, sort of where were these missionaries getting the font from? How did font develop with this missionary press?
So it's funny that, I mean, you're talking about the beauty of some of these typefaces that you're looking at. And actually, I mean, the aesthetic aspects of typography in Arabic typography in the 19th century was probably the reason why printed books, or actually, wait, scrap that. Can we redo? So the aesthetic aspects of typefaces that you're talking about with your friend, this is part of probably one of the reasons why Arabic printing doesn't become popular until the 19th century, when you get improved technologies that allow type founders to cast Arabic type that most closely resembles calligraphic script. And so the problem with Arabic printing and with Arabic typefaces is that Arabic calligraphy, the scripts in Arabic calligraphy, it hinged upon it being a cursive connected script, right? So unlike English or other Latin-based languages, you can't have gaps between letters. In early Arabic printing, and the earliest Arabic printing you get is actually, it's happening in Europe. What you would see when you look at some of these really early texts from like the 1600s is that there are gaps between the letters. There are little gaps between the letters that takes away the sort of fluidity that is intrinsic to the beauty of an Arabic script. And now these were not, these were essentially casting issues. And it's just when the individual letter forms are cast and they're then placed together, there's always going to be these little gaps. And so this was one of the main problems that the missionaries in the 19th century who were trying to develop Arabic typefaces for this press, this was an issue that they had, and they were trying to work around. Another issue that they had was the vocalization marks, right? So the vowel marks, the marks that you see on the tops and bottoms of letters that tell you that help with pronunciation when you're reading. Now, most Arabic readers would say, well, these are not absolutely important to reading an Arabic text. But for the missionaries who had a rather orientalist understanding of what locals needed when reading a book, what they needed to have on that page, they perceived vocalization to be absolutely intrinsic to this. And the problem with that is that, I mean, in addition to creating a typeface that had the kind of letter forms that were fluid enough to mimic handwritten scripts that looked connected, they also had to find a way to include these little pieces of metal that would act as vowels and find a way to arrange them arrange them within the typeface that they're setting, so that when it's printed onto the page, it doesn't look odd. It doesn't look like they're just random marks. And these were all two of many technological issues that they were facing. And so what these American missionaries did initially was that they would take samples of what they consider to be beautiful Arabic script. So they would go to calligraphers and they would have them, you know, produce multiple samples of calligraphy. And then they took these samples to a European type foundry. The first type foundry they used was in Leipzig, in Germany. And they tried to cast or design a typeface that was based on these calligraphic samples. So that a typeface that followed the general rules of Arabic calligraphy, but also found ways to work around the technological hurdles of translating a script into a typeface.
Okay. I mentioned before that there's a dissertation by a woman by the name of Catherine Schwartz, who finished her doctorate at Harvard a couple of years ago and is now working on the book version of her dissertation. And she works on Egypt and the political economy of print in Egypt. And one thing I really enjoy about the book, and I actually had to sit down and think about sort of the technology that she was writing about, is the connection between manuscript and print culture in Egypt actually has to do with lithography. So can you sort of break down lithography for our listeners and then sort of tie it into what was happening in Lebanon at the time? Because it's quite different, but it has similar results.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar in the sense that lithography and letterpress are both printing technologies. But I would actually say that that's where the similarities end. Lithography is very unique as a mode of printing, because what it does is that it allows a sort of more seamless translation of from scribal methods to printed ones. So what lithography essentially is as a method is that you would have a stone, a printing stone, and you can either draw with a crayon, a special crayon, directly onto the stone, or you would draw what you need on treated paper. You would write what you need on treated paper, and then you would transfer whatever you have on that paper onto the stone, and then you would print that particular stone. And so what this means is that you don't have to work with clunky metal type. You don't have to work with composing lines and placing them in locking them into the press and worrying about type deficiencies and worrying about how things are aligned together, because essentially you can maintain the same exact methods that you had in a scribal workshop. But now you can use them in a new technology. So the same calligrapher who was writing out a manuscript or writing out a text and including certain calligraphic elements would still be able to do the same thing, except now you do it on treated paper that is then printed. Does that make sense?
Oh, that makes absolute sense. And it's one of the reasons actually why I'm always explaining to people that Cairo isn't as important as people think it is. It is important, but it isn't as important as people think it is for printing of Arabic newspapers, because it actually starts much later in Cairo. And one of the reasons why is actually Cairo is much more dependent on lithography. Whereas in Beirut, you have the precedent of the American press. So you have Arabic newspapers coming out as early as 1858 that have longevity, that sort of have this popularity and are able to ride a wave and set the standards for the region. So it is really important that we understand the difference between these different types these different technologies. And it's also another reason why, I mean, you have this rich tradition in Cairo in the 1860s and 1850s of making, taking manuscripts and making them into printed books, because you can use the same people who wrote them out to begin with.
Exactly. Yeah. And with, in Beirut, at the American Press, what's really interesting is that they had two lithography machines. One broke and it was never fixed. Another was fixed, but they did not use it for the purposes of printing books. They used it for maps. They used it for spelling cards for schools, but they never actually used it for, you know, newspapers or for books or journals in the same way that, the press in Boulat was used both the letterpress technology and lithographic technology in their productions. And I'm not really quite sure why. It might be diverging attitudes towards lithographic printing. In general.
Yeah, it also could just be that you have this market. It's there's so many different factors, and this is important to emphasize, that tie into the history of the book. It's not just about the book. It's about economic history. It's about political history. It's about cultural history, which is why I think your study was very rich. And I think it would have been very difficult to do this mega project that involved the entire Arabic printing world. And you just do it so well, and there's so much detail. And the people who work at the press really come out as characters. You get a sense of who they are and what they're doing. So I don't want to sort of tiptoe around this, because you mentioned this in the title, the word modernity and the concept of modernity is one of the things I think the field of Middle East studies generally has had to contend with. What does modernity mean? What, you know, how do we define it? Do we use the Arabic term for it? Or do we use the term modernity because there's so much sort of theory about what the modern is? And I think what sort of goes hand in hand with this, and I've referenced this several times over this conversation, is the idea of rupture and continuity. Is, you know, does the printing press produce this huge rupture? Is there, you know, a sort of continuum? Is it a bit of both? So I suppose, what are your general thoughts on what modernity is, how we should write about it, and also, you know, what people often think accompanies modernity, which is rupture?
Right. I do think it's a little bit of both. I think when it comes to modernity, you know, as a term, as a concept, it's really about progress. And so that in and of itself is about this kind of an idea of a rupture with, you know, you define the modern by what came before it, right? There's a need for this rupture for what came before. You know, it's the modernization process that changes modes of production and the social relations to modes of productions and the relations of people with each other. I don't see it as a situation as that can be avoided when you're considering the 19th century, as the era of this, the great transformation of this period, the rise of capitalism that causes a major break. So there is that rupture with modes of production from the past and the economic system of the past. But as you say, and as I argue in my book, is that you still see a continuity. History is not linear in that sense. There is a relationship with the past, and it's an important relationship because in some ways it's a dialectical one, right? It's how you define what the present is. And what's interesting about these printed books is that you really do see that happening, that sort of dialectic taking place on the surface of these pages, where you have conventions that are clearly emulating those of the manuscripts, but they're in printed form, and you have the way that the book is arranged with the inclusion of title pages, with the inclusion of footnotes and certain other elements that we associate with modern modes of reading. You have that there. So it's clear that if you put a manuscript and a printed book from the 19th century side to side, they don't look alike. You know, you can't not say that there isn't some rupture going on, and there's rupture in the way that they were produced and also with the way that they look. But you also have these perennial motifs and this sort of continuity of an understanding of what people were expecting when they were looking at a book, what they want, what they expect books to look like, how they expect to read them. The continuity is there.
I actually think that's a general principle that one could take away from your book that is really important just to think about with regards to everyday life. I mean, more professionally, more academically, I think the same thing about newspapers. Like, you can't argue that a newspaper existed before, in the Arabic speaking context, before a certain period. You can't. There just wasn't the same equivalent. Print really made it possible to mass produce something, because I think having a general audience and intending something to get to a general audience is a really big part of the story. But what I also think is, you look at a newspaper and you're like, ah, that kind of looks like chronicle writing, or like the fact that they privilege poetry. You know, Arabic poetry has been around for over a millennia. So there are all these different elements of continuity and change. And I think it's also something you can apply to sort of how you think about everyday life, is that there aren't these, you know, a revolution happens and life doesn't change. Things take time, but also some things do change immediately. So as I've mentioned multiple times, I absolutely love your book. I came across it because I think it was really an ally for me. It's something I could sort of both use to inform my own arguments, but also something that I sort of trace the sources, something I can be in conversation with. And I am glad that the history of the book is sort of featuring this revival in Middle East history, Middle East studies, because all of these different fields of history intersect, be it the history of print, be it art history, be it book history, be it intellectual history. And again, your book is sort of a really good example of how one could do almost, you know, three or four or five different things at the same time and see them as part of one continuum. So how do you see the relationship between art history, book history, intellectual history, and what should it be? What do you aspire to?
Well, yeah, I mean, I see intellectual history as the kind of the big umbrella, and, you know, smaller disciplines like art history and book history and so on would fit within this large umbrella. And the link, the important link, or the link that needs to be emphasized here is the methodology. Art history and book history each have their very, you know, distinct fields and the very distinct methodologies. Art history employs methods of visual analysis, while book history turns to bibliographic and literary approaches. But what's really interesting is that, you know, these methods can certainly inform each other and can certainly inform the intellectual history of the book itself. And this is something that I attempted to do in this book. I mean, we call it interdisciplinarity today, but I also feel like interdisciplinarity has become too much of a fluid, easy term that you're not really sure what it means at some point. I think it's important to maintain the integrity of each discipline, but I also think it's equally important to think about the ways in which we can borrow methods from different disciplines and have a much more nuanced approach to an intellectual history of this particular period of the 19th century.
So I'm going to do something that is a little unconventional. I want to ask you about something that's out of the purview of your book. Let's just jump forward, you know, a century and a half or a century or so. The transition between print to digital text, both sort of generally, but also in the specific Arabic context, what changed? Is it the same sort of big moment of rupture? No, is it a moment of rupture? But is it also this moment of continuity and rupture as we've discussed throughout this episode?
Yeah, I mean, of course, everybody talks about, we have the debates about the death of the book in the digital era and all the stuff in the 80s and the 90s. And so, most people would say that, yes, there is this significant rupture that you have at this point in time. I'm not really sure if it's quite a rupture. I it's not something that I work on specifically, but thinking more broadly about this, I mean, modes of production have more or less been the same in the sense that we're still a part of a capitalist system, right? And this is the late capitalist period. There isn't this major shift. It's not like the great transformation that we saw at the end of the 19th century. In the 20th century. But you do see a shift in the way in which notions of reading and what books look like are being manifested visually, right? So we get the shift from the surface of the page to the screen. And that's something that definitely requires new ways of understanding text, new ways of thinking about what text needs to look like. What it's not thinking about a typeface that is cast in metal is absolutely not like thinking about how you would represent a typeface in pixels, right? So, I mean, you're already dealing with very different technologies here. And so you do see the kind of disjuncture between these different modes. But at the same time, if you look at the digital books or digital text, when the digital was first emerging as a thing, it's remarkable how much some of these things look like, or they try to emulate the printed page, right? And it's only more recently that you see more innovations and thinking about new ways of reading and new conceptions of what books are and how we should approach them or how we read.
So I just want to congratulate you again on the book. It is, and again, I keep gushing, but it's a phenomenal contribution to the field. It's a really well detailed piece of work. It's nuanced, it's thoughtful. And I neglected to mention this, but I believe you won the Mesa Dissertation Prize a couple of years ago.
No, actually, let me correct you. It was an honorable mention.
So. Oh. Same difference.
Yeah, no. No, please. No, I was an honorable mention in the humanities. I didn't win. The person who works on music in Iran won, I think. So it's, yeah.
Okay. Very, very humble of you. But no matter what, that's an achievement because hundreds of dissertations are produced every year. And that your book, that your dissertation was an honorable mention even. And then the book came out so quickly afterwards and so efficiently and so well done. It's such an accomplishment.
Thank you. Thanks for saying that.
So for my last question, we always sort of ask for a teaser. What projects do you have in the pipeline? I'm particularly excited about your work in modern science, actually, science in the Arabic context.
Yeah, I actually have a few things that I'm working on. I mean, that's what's so great about finishing that first book is like, you know, it's always this huge the albatross around your neck, and you need to get that first book out and get that first bunch of research out. But now that that's done, I've actually been taking my time and thinking about different things. And one of them, yes, is this idea about the modern sciences in the 19th century in places like Beirut and Cairo. And specifically what I've been noticing is I've been looking at journals more recently. And so in a lot of these journals, they were these literary scientific journals that many historians have written about, were used as a way to popularize notions of what modern science was. And what I noticed is that in much of the work out there, very few people talk about the visual conventions, but more importantly, very few people talk about the fact that these are actually illustrated. And illustrations play an important role here because in the work that I have been doing on the printed book and the earlier printed book, you really don't get a lot of illustrations. You do occasionally get some illustrations, but they're very far and few in between. With these periodicals, you have these really interesting engravings and we know nothing about them. We have no idea where they came from. We don't know whether we have local people working on these types of engravings. But what it does is sort of it opens up all these questions that you can now ask and think about wider global connections. And what I've been finding is that a lot of these illustrations in scientific journals may have been altered locally, but also were coming from European and American sources, and that they were being produced and printed at the same time as similar publications in the West. And so you get an image of Alexander Graham demonstrating his telephone in 1876 in Al-Muqtataf in Beirut. And in that same year, 1877, sorry. And in that same year, you have a similar article on it in the UK and in the US. And so it really tells us it's a really interesting way to think about questions of contemporaneity and what the sciences, what the modern sciences were being used, how the modern sciences were being utilized by this group of intellectuals to popularize certain ideas about modernity and modernization.
crowd. I want to read that book now. But again, thank you for spending this time with me. It's an achievement, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Thank you. Thank you for this.